Chapter 10, The Approval Button. It's the rare parent who never sees her child as a reflection of herself. Some go to extremes. From supermarket behavior to the college choice, an approval-seeking parent watches her child while keenly sensing the eyes of others watching her. The pressure's on, and if her child does not behave according to her standards, she fears embarrassment. The world will confirm that she has failed and will see her as the fake she fears herself to be. Approval-seeking parents are trying to avoid their shame when they tell their children, "Say hello to Mrs. Jones." "You will wear what I tell you to wear." Or, "Stop embarrassing me." These are ways to manipulate children to guarantee that stamp of approval from the outside world. And the "I'm the best parent" award goes to... Many parents still work hard for the approval of their own parents. The strings are still tightly attached. Often the assumed feelings of their parents take precedence over the feelings of their child. The parent feels caught in the middle and defers to the old pattern, risking their children's needs in the process. When their button is pushed, approval-seeking parents feel exposed and embarrassed. Looking good is their ultimate protection. Children of approval-seeking parents typically feel incompetent, unlovable, ashamed, and never good enough. When children push the approval button, they are saying, "Stop listening to what other people think and listen to what you and I need." I'm between a rock and a hard place. Eleanor and Sydney, age 8. Eleanor is a tired and stressed young mother, drained of energy yet determined in her mission. She claims responsibility for everything Sydney and her younger brother do, have ever done, and will ever do. "Their happiness is my responsibility," she said emphatically. Eleanor has to make sure they never have a problem because their behavior is a direct reflection of her competence as a parent. She's exhausted by the vigilance the job requires. She says she's constantly putting out fires and fixing their problems. She relayed the following story to the class. Eleanor's mother, Adrian, was visiting the day of Sydney's final softball game. Sydney had missed the previous two games, so this day's game was especially important to her. Before it was time to leave, Eleanor asked Sydney if she had all her gear together. Sydney said she couldn't find her glove. Eleanor suggested she better look for it, but Sydney slid farther down in her seat and whined, "I can't, you find it." Embarrassed by her daughter's behavior in front of her mother, Eleanor insisted that Sydney look. But when the whining and stubbornness continued, Eleanor began her search in hopes that Sydney would be happy and stop whining. Adrian had often complained that Sydney was spoiled and needed a good spanking. Uncomfortable under her mother's scrutiny, Eleanor was sure this was what her mother was thinking now. She recalled the many times in her childhood when her mother had criticized her silly desires and spanked her each time she heard a whine or a complaint. Eleanor had worked hard in school to win her mother's approval, but each B was criticized for not being an A, and each A was criticized for not being an A+. The search for the elusive baseball glove went upstairs, downstairs, inside and out. Sydney was complaining at her mother's heels everywhere she went. At one point in the backyard, a frantic Sydney yelled at her mother, "You are so stupid! Why can't you find it? We've got to go soon!" Speechless, Eleanor darted a warning look toward Sydney. Adrian began muttering about a spanking just loud enough to entangle Eleanor with familiar feelings of inadequacy. Even as an adult, she could never get it right. As Eleanor's anger continued to build, she took a last trip upstairs with Sydney tagging behind. While Eleanor scoured the bookshelves, Sydney, who up until this point had not helped in the search at all, picked up her pajamas from the floor of her closet and uncovered the Holy Grail. Shrieking with delight, pride written all over her face, Sydney exclaimed, "Mom, look! I found my glove!" It was all Eleanor could do to contain her rage. Seeing the look on Sydney's face, she realized that Sydney had instantly forgotten all that had just happened and was now ready to go to the game. Eleanor was frozen. She glared into Sydney's sparkling eyes with a "How dare you embarrass me in front of my mother" stare, and sternly told her to sit on her bed and be quiet. She staggered into the hall and sat on the stairs, heading down to the kitchen, her head in her hands. She was trapped. Above her were the wails of her daughter, now fearing the worst, and below her was her mother pacing back and forth, tossing critical glances up the stairs. Adrian won. Eleanor knew she could not let Sidney off the hook without being accused of raising a spoiled brat. She told Sidney that she would not be going to the game after behaving the way she had. She went back downstairs to face her mother's criticism of Sidney's astonishingly rude behavior, while screams of, "It's not fair!" rained from upstairs. Clearly, Sidney's agenda was different from her mother's. She intended to go to the game and win. She wanted her mother to be proud of her. She knew playing well was important to her mother. Plus, she had missed the past two games. She had to be there. Perhaps her friends on the team would give her grief for missing again. Sidney fully expected her mother to find the glove, as she always had. Mothers just do that. When her mother couldn't find it, Sidney got anxious. Her surprise at unearthing the glove herself filled her with pride and elation. She assumed her mother would be proud of her. But no, what were those glaring, accusing eyes telling her? This wasn't her mother. What was happening? No warning, unless you help with this search, or until you stop these rude remarks, you will not be going to this game, had been given to Sidney. And it was a familiar scenario. Sidney had never before been expected to take responsibility for lost objects. Why would this time be any different? But she didn't take into account the powerful influence her grandmother held over her mother. Putting her children's happiness first, Eleanor had actually set Sidney up to treat her disrespectfully. Eleanor had taught Sidney over the years to expect her to take responsibility for Sidney's things. So when her mother was not behaving as she had come to expect, Sidney got angry. Not an appropriate response, but a logical one. Eleanor could not see what part of the situation was her responsibility and what part was Sidney's. She felt trapped. She went for her mother's approval. Had Adrian not been there, Eleanor probably would have given in and taken Sidney to the game, fuming inside with resentment but putting her daughter's happiness first. As it was, Eleanor was caught between a rock and a hard place, between her mother's approval and her daughter's happiness. If Eleanor believes that she is incompetent and worthless, then her children's behavior is critical to her self-worth. When they are happy and behaving properly, she can relax. But when Sidney is rude and disrespectful, her belief is triggered and she feels threatened. She reacts with anger but has no idea how to find balance in the situation. Her ability to hold Sidney accountable for her behavior is too hard given her need to make her happy. But her need for her mother's approval beats all else. It's too easy to fall back into her pattern of incompetence when her mother is glaring over her shoulder. It keeps her relationship with her mother safe, but it puts her at high risk in her relationship with her daughter. But she's been in a relationship with her mother a good deal longer than with her daughter. Had Eleanor felt more competent in her abilities, she would have been able to set up clear guidelines with Sidney. If her button were diffused, she could have said with no emotional stake at all, "Sidney, I'd like you to spend 10 minutes looking for your glove. If you haven't found it by then, I will help. But better get started now, because we will need to leave in half an hour." If Sidney had refused, a detached Eleanor might have been able to say, "When you've looked for 10 minutes, let me know whether you found it or not. If you don't want to look, that tells me you don't want to go to the game." It would then be Sidney's choice whether to look for her glove or miss another game. Don't embarrass me in public. Leslie and Brian, age 6, Beth, 8, and Peter, 12. Leslie came to the When Your Kids Push Your Buttons class quite distraught because her son's teacher had suggested that she get him evaluated for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. She did not want Brian to be coded with a label that would live with him throughout his school years. She felt sure she could handle him. She just wasn't sure how. Brian is the youngest of Leslie's 3 children and is the one who pushes her buttons the hardest. "He's in my face all the time," she protested. "He just never stops. I'm exhausted. God knows how I'll make it to, let alone through, his teens." Leslie's fear of the ADHD label has made her determined to figure him out. After a few classes, she shared with us the following story. One day while shopping, Leslie experienced every mother's worst nightmare. She had promised her kids a trip to the lake, but wanted to do two errands on the way. Her first stop was a quick pickup at the grocery store while the kids stayed in the car. When she returned, Brian was miserable. He complained about how hot he was and whined, "Didn't you bring me anything to drink?" The tone of his voice, although familiar, set Leslie off, and she retorted with annoyance, "How was I supposed to know you were hot and thirsty? You'll have to wait till we get to the lake." The second stop was at Marshall's to get the boys some socks. Brian insisted on coming in, much to Leslie's dismay. She hated going into stores with him. She tried to find the socks quickly and escape, but Brian hung on her, persisted loudly about getting to the lake, and complained that he was dying of thirst. She prayed that no one was watching. As she turned to tell him to let go of her arm, an older woman appeared, pointed her finger at Brian, and snapped, "Your behavior is not only distressing your mother, but every other shopper in this store." Leslie looked at her in horror, too shocked to speak. The woman gave them both a disdainful shake of her head and disappeared behind ladies' dresses. Leslie was mortified. This woman embodied all her fears of what other people must be thinking. She blew. "You see how your behavior bothers other people, too? Now maybe you'll listen when I tell you to stop," she yelled loudly for the benefit of those who were watching, waiting to see what she would do. Brian kept on about the lake. In this moment of confrontation, Leslie's small voice that knows Brian is unique and requires unique parenting shut down. Instead, a louder, harsher voice spoke, telling her that she had failed to raise a child worthy of approval. It confirmed her fears that Brian really is an ADHD child, that she really isn't cut out for parenting, and that indeed this woman was absolutely right. Hindsight helped Leslie see that her sudden reaction to Brian resulted from her embarrassment at being seen as a bad mother raising an uncontrollable child. Not until much later did she consider that the woman's intrusive remark was highly inappropriate. Leslie was willing to forego being her child's ally, to believe wholeheartedly the judgment of a total stranger, to, in effect, betray her child. Leslie's standard tells her that children should do what their parents tell them, whether they like it or not. Her first two children were proof to her that that standard is appropriate. If I told them to leave the room because I needed to make a phone call, they would do it. If I tell Brian to leave the room, he will find every possible excuse not to and insist on talking to the person himself, she said with disdain. Leslie's standard does not allow for a child who is temperamentally different. If she's shopping in a crowded store and he begs to leave, her attitude is, "I have to do this and you're coming with me because I say so," even though she knows that noises and too much stimulation set him off. Leslie is confused by Brian's temperament rather than understanding of it. She assumes that she should be able to teach him to behave like her other two children. After her work in the class, Leslie understood that at the time of the incident, her agenda was all that mattered. When he didn't go along with it, she clenched her teeth and tried to remain calm, but her tension was picked up on his radar screen. He knew she wanted him to behave properly in public. The problem was that her definition of proper was not something he knew how to do. He became rigid whenever he sensed he was not meeting her approval, and his behavior accelerated. After a number of classes, Leslie had a success story. She and all three children were in the dentist's office, waiting for Brian's appointment. Leslie was making a plan with Brian's older sister to go Christmas shopping. Brian looked up from the toy box on the other side of the room and cried, "I have to go, too!" "No, I'm taking Beth. I spend a lot of time doing things like that with you. Now it's her turn." Leslie said she was amazed at her calmness and clarity, even though she feared his reaction. She knew that the empty waiting room helped. Brian continued crying, forgetting how much he hates shopping. His agenda was to be included. Too often Leslie said okay when Brian complained, and her daughter felt resentful whenever he tagged along. This time she said again calmly, "If you want to scream, why don't you go in the coat room?" To Leslie's amazement, he did. He feigned a few fake screams, stomped back into the waiting room, plopped down on a chair, and pulled his coat over his head. Leslie continued the book she had started to read to the other two. In a few minutes, Brian pulled the coat off his head, sat straight up, and declared, "You're right. I realized under my coat that I do get to do a lot of special things with you. It's okay. You can go with Beth." I pointed out to Leslie that she hadn't blamed him for his initial reaction. She gave him something to do with his frustration and allowed him to work it through. The empty waiting room was a good place to practice her new skills. Leslie's standard, children should do what their parents tell them whether they like it or not, is what gets threatened when Brian's behavior embarrasses her in public. She's working on letting go of what others will think. At first, she worried that this meant letting him get away with being rude, but she soon saw that the tension she felt while trying to uphold this standard in public actually aggravated Brian's tension and inevitable rude behavior. The tension was not there in the dentist's waiting room. She could try out her new understanding of what lies beneath his behavior instead of reacting to it as usual. What must people think? Barbara and Lily, age 3. She's making my life so difficult. I'm a total loser. She's being a brat. These were the assumptions that were hard to draw out of Barbara. She was so afraid the others in the group would think she was a terrible mother that it wasn't until several weeks into the group that we heard anything from her. "I was so afraid of what people would think of me," she said, after she understood how common her struggle was. She became more open about sharing what a bad mother she thought she was. Barbara is a 20-year-old single mom struggling to balance a full-time job and a very strong-willed 3-year-old. "Why do you think you're a bad mother?" I asked. "Because I can't get Lily to do what I say. She won't eat and she won't use the toilet when I tell her to. I know she's doing it just to get me. She's perfectly capable of going to the toilet, but now she's withholding her poop. When I put her on her potty seat, she refuses to go. She's fine at daycare, which really gets me. She'll do it for them, but not for me. I exploded at her when she woke me up in the middle of the night to tell me she'd pooped." "Why do you think it's your fault?" another group member asked. "Because I can't get her potty trained. What's wrong with me, anyhow?" Barbara began to tear up. "My friends come over and say, 'She's not potty trained? What's with that?' I get so upset, and I blame myself for divorcing her father and having to work such long hours. I have to do everything alone." She hung her head silently for a minute and then continued, "But the worst is my father. He has this 'I told you so' attitude about my ex-husband and won't help me out because he says I made my bed and now I have to lie in it. But whenever Lily has an accident, and of course that happens every time we're at my parents' house, my father gives that look. I know he's saying, 'What's the matter with you? You can't even mother properly.' Oh, I can't ever get it right." When she was a child, Barbara's father never actually told her she was bad. She just knew it from the way he exuded his disapproval. Barbara admitted to being slightly rebellious as a teenager, but mostly she remained a good girl to avoid her father's evil eye, as she called it. "It was that look. That's all he had to do," she said, "and I knew I was in trouble." "What kind of trouble?" I asked. "Well, that's the funny thing," she said. "We never really got spanked or grounded or anything. It was just that look that told us we'd been bad. It gives me the shivers now just to picture my father's face. And about anything, if I came in late for dinner, said something he didn't like, or wanted something he didn't want me to have, I just felt so incredibly guilty." It was the withdrawal of approval from her father that kept Barbara and her sisters in line. Their father's silence and stony look signaled his disapproval and disappointment. "I saw that look, and I felt about as small as an insect. Then I would have to win it back. I would do all sorts of nice things for him until I got a smile once again. Sometimes it was days before he'd change. Then it was touch and go until the next incident. It sure did the trick." The trick resulted in Barbara seeking approval anywhere she could get it, even from 3-year-old Lily. When Lily behaves properly, uses the potty, eats a good meal, is cute and charming when we're with anyone else, I give myself this huge pat on the back. It's like she's my seal of approval, Barbara confessed with a little embarrassment. Barbara's father had managed well to teach his daughters how to behave the way he wanted, but the fallout was great. What he probably didn't intend by withdrawing his approval was the resulting insecurity his daughter felt about anything she attempted, even with her own child. "But most of the time, Lily makes me feel like a total loser as a mother," Barbara said. "It's like she's throwing in my face everything I doubt about myself." "Isn't it amazing how that happens?" I said. "Our children are constantly pointing out to us our greatest faults and then rubbing salt in the wounds. What do you think she's trying to tell you?"
"I don't get what you mean." Barbara was confused.
"When Lily refuses to eat or use the potty, she's pushing your button, and that button is causing you to think she's a brat and is out to get you. If you think that, you will, of course, react with anger." Barbara nodded. "But when she pushes that button, she's attempting to tell you something about yourself. If you think you're a loser at mothering because she won't use the potty, that means you're using her behavior for your validation. So if she fails, you fail. You're asking from her what you wanted from your father."
"Wow. So if he had approved of me, I would be better able to handle Lily?" she asked quizzically.
"Well, I don't think you would take her behavior so personally if you felt more confident of yourself. She's most likely asking for more power when she resists eating and toileting. She's telling you that, not what a bad mother you are. You perceive your father criticizing your mothering and project that onto Lily. When Lily pushes her buttons, all of Barbara's needs for approval rear up to smack her in the face. She does not want to be reminded of what a bad girl, bad mother she is, so she turns her blame on Lily. The pressure is on Lily to perform, to show what a good mother Barbara is, but Lily is her mother's teacher. She will persist in her resistance until her mother learns that her button is about herself, not about Lily. I told Barbara that when little children feel powerless, they take it out on their parents in the areas of toileting, eating, and sleeping, where they know they have ultimate control. We talked about the many ways she could give Lily more control in her daily life by giving her choices, taking her agenda into consideration, and validating her feelings, even if Barbara doesn't like them. Another working mother in the group asked Barbara if she thought Lily might be angry about the hours her mother is away. This was hard for Barbara to talk about because of the guilt she felt at leaving her daughter in daycare for long hours. But when she heard other mothers discussing not only their own guilt but their strategies, she perked up. She decided to talk to Lily about how unhappy she must feel about being separated from her mom all day. She would tell her that each day, after playground time, Barbara would arrive, and then Lily could choose what they would do together for the first half hour at home. "But what about the potty training?" Barbara asked. "The key is not to expect potty training to validate your worth. When you don't have that pressure on yourself anymore, you will let up on Lily and she can relax. You may never get your father's approval, but if you can give unconditional approval to Lily, whether she's potty trained or not, you'll be able to give yourself approval for a job well done. Listen to Lily. She will keep pushing you until you give yourself what you're demanding from her. She can't give it to you, but she can provide you with the opportunity to give it to yourself." Barbara was still struggling at the end of the class, but her final exercise showed that progress was happening slowly. Her new standard, "My daughter is in charge of her own body, and I can give her my approval even when she has an accident," says that Barbara's perception has changed. She understands the importance of Lily taking responsibility for herself in the areas of previous resistance. When she can give Lily what she longed for from her father, Barbara will help herself as well as Lily.